I would like to tell you something about DNA, something about the interactions between DNA molecules, something about the mesophases that DNA makes in solution, and how to understand the equation of state of these mesophases. So what is DNA? What is DNA? It's, of course, as you know, a long polymer. It's very charged. It's a double helix. It's got one charge on each phosphate group, and it's got two phosphate groups per base pair. So we have two charges per 3.4 nanometers, and the pitch of DNA is about 34 angstroms. So it's a very charged molecule and also a very stiff molecule.
Could we have a little of a light on top? Because it makes it very hard to take notes.
If we dissolve DNA in solution, it likes to dissolve because it's charged, of course, and it makes different phases depending on the concentration of DNA, and I will tell you more about that later on. DNA can have different local conformations of the base pairs. Usually we talk about the B conformation, in which the base pairs are mostly parallel. The diameter of the B conformation is about 20 angstroms. Also, I'll be talking about A conformation, which is a variation on the B conformation. It exists only at low hydration conditions, and you see that the base pairs sort of go in a curvy line as you progress along the axis of the molecule. This diameter is about 22 nanometers, and if you look at the A-DNA from the top, it's got a little hole in the middle.
So DNA
can be described with elastic constant, or if you want, the persistence length, which is the length of the molecule that gives you a kT of elastic energy if you wrap it into a semicircle. For DNA, the value of the persistence length is about 50 nanometers, and you see it's sort of in between. It's difficult to say whether this is very stiff or not very stiff, but hyaluronic acid, another very important polyelectrolyte, has a persistence length of about 1 nanometer, and schizophyllin, another polyelectrolyte, which is actually a triple helix, has a persistence length of 200 nanometers. Why is it important what DNA makes in solution? Well, it's important because in biological systems, DNA is extremely condensed. Please take a look at this figure here. We have a little virus here. Actually, it's a bacterial virus, bacteriophage T2. And you see, can you see this? There's DNA exploding out of the virus. So all this DNA has been condensed into this little space here. And to do that, to go to the concentrations of DNA of about 500 milligrams per milliliter of the solution, you have to apply an osmotic pressure of about 100 atmospheres. So inside the virus head, there's an osmotic pressure of 100 atmospheres acting, and that's a lot. You can get actually even higher than that, to 500 and so on, depending on which virus you take a look at or what the concentration of DNA is. So it's important what kind of structures DNA makes at this very large concentrations, because this is what you have in let's say, viruses, some viruses. So what kind of mesophases does DNA make in solution? This is a comparison for those who know what the mesophases are for lipid molecules. You know, if you dissolve lipid molecules, you will first go from a micellar solution to a hexagonal array, to a lamellar array, to inverted hexagonal array, inverted micellar array. And in the same way, if you concentrate DNA, if you go from low to very high concentration of DNA, you will go through a sequence of phases that we now think are basically isotropic solution, blue phase, cholesteric phase, line hexatic phase, hexagonal columnar liquid crystal, and orthorhombic crystal, but also for sodium DNA in a crystal, DNA is in A conformation and not in B, so it's a little bit complicated. But still, this is the sequence of phases that you see for DNA. And just to give you a flavor, here is the cholesteric phase of DNA. Can everybody see the fingerprint pattern that you see in the cross polarizers under a microscope? You can easily measure that the pitch of the cholesteric phase for DNA at usual conditions is about between 1 and 2 microns. So it's macroscopic. You can see the same pitch here. This is all for short fragment DNA. DNA you can make, and molecular biologists help you to do that. You can make DNA very short. The shortest you can make is 146 base pairs, which is about one persistence length long, and you can go all the way to microns, tens of microns, so you really have a lot of span here in terms of the length effects or something else that you want to study. This is short fragment DNA that you can, of course, orient in a magnetic field. It gives nice domains. And the plasmid DNA, which is, on the other hand, circular and close, give you similar phases, and I'm not going to go into details here. How do you measure the equation of state once you have a certain mesophase? Well, this is the way you do it. Either you take a piston, this is my DNA in some sort of a mesophase, and I push on it through a membrane. That's how I exert osmotic pressure on it. And at the same time, I measure the relative volume per DNA molecule, and I can get a force curve, or not a force curve, an equation of state that connects the osmotic pressure and the volume per DNA molecule. I can also do it in a different way, because this is not really how you can do it. We don't know how to do this experiment, but we do a similar experiment. What do you do here? You take a subphase of DNA, put a semi-permeable membrane on top of it, and then on the other side of the membrane, you add another polymer. Usually this is polyethylene glycol or polyvinyl pyrrolidone or some other neutral polymer that exerts osmotic pressure on this subphase. So by sort of weighing one osmotic pressure versus the other one, you can get the osmotic pressure of this subphase, and again you measure the volume and you get the equation of state. I hope this was sort of reasonably clear. In the membrane?
No, between separating the two. Is it an actual interface, or is it an actual
subphase? This is just a membrane that then closes the DNA subphase. That's all.
What's of the membrane?
Oh, it's one of these membranes that you can just buy.
Semi.
No. Yes, exactly. It's a bag. This has got nothing to do with lipids. This is not a lipid membrane. It's a bag. You put your DNA in there. Water can exchange, and therefore you can osmotically equilibrate the two phases. That's the idea. So what kind of equation of state do you see? Now, first of all, DNA can exist at various conditions. And I will concentrate on one single line in the phase diagram. If I draw your attention to the van der Waals phase diagram, it's like picking a single isotherm in the phase diagram. My isotherm is not really an isotherm, it's an isoionic strength line. And it will correspond to the 0.5 molar sodium chloride. Yeah? So this is one, like, isoionic strength line in the phase diagram. And what you see here is the log of the osmotic pressure versus, it's not really volume, it's an effective spacing between the between DNA molecules, but it's basically the same. It's no big deal. So what you see here is, if I start at high density, we have a crystalline phase right here in which DNA is, first of all, in A conformation, and it makes an orthorhombic crystal. Meaning that if we look at it perpendicular to the long axis of the molecule, the hexagonal lattice is a little bit deformed. Then you have a first order transition, and you go from a crystalline phase to something that we call a line hexatic phase. I will explain to you what this is in a moment. Then, this is the region we don't yet understand, but then you reach the transition to a cholesteric phase. You move along the cholesteric line. Maybe there are some blue phases on the way. We are not sure. There's some evidence for that. We are not really sure. And then you have an emetic isotropic transition, and DNA is finally in an isotropic solution. Right here, we have 1,000 atmospheres, 100, 10, 1 atmosphere. This is osmotic pressure. These two points here correspond to cracking of the helix, because the forces acting on it are too large, and the helix cannot withstand such pressure. So we have, once again, crystalline, line hexatic, cholesteric, maybe blue phases, isotropic. This is a single ionic strength line. 0.5 molar sodium chloride. No, this is, oh, thank you. This is long DNA. Most of the experiments that I'm going to show you are for long DNA. What is long? It's on the order of a micron at least.
So that's many lengths.
Yes, many persistence lengths. Yeah. Yeah.
So A form is higher, much larger.
Pardon?
Crystalline A form occurs much larger.
This is the experiment. Oh, what I showed is the experiment of Lindsay. I'm not sure which. But this is at what osmotic pressure?
It's about 8.3, 8.4.
Maybe. Aren't you talking about lithium DNA? It's lithium DNA.
Sodium DNA is lithium DNA.
Okay, maybe we can, you know, yeah, we'll talk about that. So I told you that in the phase diagram, just below the crystalline phase, you see a line hexatic phase. In 83, John Toner, just theoretically studying the phases that are possible with the pneumatic polymers, came with the idea that pneumatic polymers can make something called, that he called N plus 6 phase, which is a pneumatic phase plus hexatic perpendicular to the long axis of the molecule. What does that mean? What would be a line hexatic phase? Imagine we are in a crystal. If I sit on a molecule in this crystal and then move away for a lattice vector, I know exactly, once I move a lattice vector away, I know where the next neighbors are, where the first neighbors are, not only at what angles, yeah, but also exactly at what spacings. In a line hexatic phase, you could do the same. And now imagine these are just DNA molecules. You would know at what angles the first neighbors are, but not exactly where in space they are located. So that's the difference between a line hexatic phase and a hexagonal columnar liquid crystalline phase. And how do you know it's a line hexatic phase? Well, the way you know it is that you do X-ray scattering in the direction of the long axis of the molecule. And this is the sample that you have. It's highly oriented sample, and I have to mention here the name of Alan Ruprecht from the University of Stockholm that prepares these samples. It's basically an art to prepare an ordered sample of long DNA. With short fragment DNA, it's easy to do it. You can use magnetic field. With long DNA, this is extremely difficult to do. Few people can do it. It's really a long procedure, almost an art. But once you have the sample, which is macroscopically oriented, you can put it into the X-ray beam in different directions, and you get different scattering. And the imprint of the line hexatic order in the scattering is that you can see these six broad peaks. Right here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If you scatter X-rays in the direction of the long axis of the molecule, this is the imprint of the hexatic order. And here I have it once again, the six peaks that you see, very broad peaks. So these broad peaks indicate there is no positional order, the sample is liquid-like, but there is bond orientational order, meaning that you know at what angles the first neighbors are, and they're of course at 60 degrees. If you Fourier decompose the scattering intensity in the angular variable, this angle, you get different Fourier coefficients, and the first Fourier coefficient I will call the hexatic order parameter. And you can actually see that as you go through the line hexatic cholexteric transition, the hexatic order parameter goes continuously to zero. And here you can see it. This is high in the line hexatic phase, in the middle, and at the end. You see the six spots that gradually disappear, and this graph just quantifies this disappearance of the hexatic order. Also, if you look at the dynamics of the DNA, as it goes through a line hexadic cholesteric transition, you will see that this is P31 NMR line shape. I'm not sure whether you can really see that, but what you're supposed to see is that in the cholesteric phase, the NMR line is much narrower than in the line hexadic phase, meaning that suddenly a lot of motion appears. DNA fluctuates a lot in the cholesteric phase. In the line hexadic phase, it fluctuates less. So before I showed you the equation of state just for one sort of canonical value of the ionic strength, that was 0.5 molar sodium chloride. And here you can see the same thing, but for different ionic strengths. Here we go from 2 molar, I think, to 0.1 molar. So you see that, in a way, if I compare this to the van der Waals phase diagram, the ionic strength plays the role of the temperature. Yeah? So let's say this line here, the squares, full squares, would correspond to 2 molar equation of state. That would be 0.1 molar equation of state. Everything here is sodium chloride. And at this point, approximately, you would have a transition from a line hexadic to a cholesteric phase. Here's the crystalline phase. I don't have the transition point for every ionic strength because we didn't explore that very carefully. We only have it carefully explored for one ionic strength.
So what does sodium DNA mean?
The what?
You have sodium DNA there. You distinguish it from
lithium DNA. Oh, you can add different counter ions, of course. And lithium versus sodium would maybe displace a little bit this part of the curve, but down here it would essentially remain the same. Of course, if you go from monovalent to divalent, that's a completely different story. I don't even want to go into that. I think that other people here will have talks on that, so I will not touch that subject at all. What kind of interactions do we expect between DNA molecules? Let me just briefly go through something I'm sure everybody knows. First of all, we have the mean field electrostatic forces, meaning we have fixed charges on the molecules. We have the corresponding profile of the potential, electrostatic potential, going into the solution. Two such molecules, when they're in close separation, would therefore interact with one another. The way we calculate these interactions is in the mean field, on the mean field or Poisson-Boltzmann level, we take the elastic electrostatic energy density, add ideal gas entropy, get something, a functional of E and the divergence of E, which is what we get through Poisson's equation, and then minimize it, solve it for boundary conditions, this, that. At the end, we get for two DNA molecules an expression that gives us the free energy of interaction as a function of the separation between the two molecules. Of course, this result is very approximate, only for very small potentials or small charges, and there are other ways to do it when you have large potentials or large charges on the molecule. And you see that the free energy scales as the length of the molecule. It goes as the square of the linear charge density, epsilon is the dielectric constant, K0, the Bessel function, kappa 1 over the Debye characteristic, Debye screening length, which is written right here. And if we want to, we can actually express the same dependence, not in terms of the effective line charge density, but in terms of the surface charge density on DNA. I will not make any distinction between the two here. Also, if the DNA are not parallel, but are skewed at a certain angle, this is what we get. This is a result that is on the same level of accuracy as this equation. They are the same level of accuracy. This is mean field, both of them. And we see that it goes as, now this is the free energy of interaction. It depends also on the angle, and of course, not of course, it goes as 1 over sine theta. You see that it diverges as theta goes to 0, but that simply indicates that if you have very long molecules, the interaction energy scales as length. If length is infinite, it's infinite. That's all it means. Now, on top of the mean field forces, or the Poisson-Boltzmann forces, of course, we also have van der Waals forces. And in the Lipschitz theory of van der Waals forces, they originate in the fluctuations of the electromagnetic field in space and are dependent on the frequency dependence of the dielectric constant. And for DNA molecules, we know that the dielectric constant in the direction of the long axis of the DNA and the dielectric constant perpendicular to that axis is different. We have to take that into account. And here I have them. Parallel, perpendicular, and epsilon m is just the dielectric constant of the medium. Let's say this is aqueous solution. If I define these three quantities, I can write the interaction energy corresponding to van der Waals forces in this form. This is for skewed molecules. This is for parallel molecules. Again, you see the same thing. For parallel molecules, it scales as the length. For skewed molecules, it doesn't, of course, but depends on the angle between the molecule. And the angular dependence now is 1 over sine, which is the same as for the mean field forces, but it's got an additional term which complicates matters a little bit, but not too much. The main dependence of the van der Waals free energy is like r to the minus 5 for the parallel case and 1 over r to the 4 for the skewed case. And what I have here is a summation over all the frequencies which you get from the Lipschitz theory, and I don't have time to go into details, but we could simply term this the Hamaker constant and this the angular dependent Hamaker constant. Now, if in the solution we don't only have water but also salt or ions in general, we know that the first order omega zero term in this sum is screened. So van der Waals interactions can be screened in the same way as the interactions, mean field interactions between DNA molecules can be screened in the Poisson-Boltzmann theory. And the zero order term becomes screened. This is the same. So this is the interaction energy for the skewed case, for the parallel case. But this is only one term in this sum here, only the zero order term. And you see that it's screened. And the screening length is half the screening length that you would have for the bihookal interactions. Yes, yes, it is. It is. Thank you. And this is a salient feature of the van der Waals or fluctuation interaction in general, that it's more screened than the mean field part of the interaction. You see, on the level of the Poisson-Boltzmann equation or linearized Poisson-Boltzmann equation, it's twice as screened. This terms here, and the angular dependence is more complicated in this case, and again, for parallel molecules, it scales as the length of the molecule. With a what?
Solvent.
This is right here. Yes, yes, it's right here, epsilon m. That's a solvent dielectric constant. That's in this term.
It's all absorbed into the dielectric constant.
Right, exactly. I'm not sure I understand the question.
If you were allowed to do things on a scale of, let's say, 5 angstroms rather than 1 or 2 angstroms?
Yes. Oh, God, I can't remember offhand. But if you look at the total value of the magnitude of the interaction, you will see that it's about, in the range of separations that I was talking about before, it's about 1 to 2 orders of magnitude smaller than the bihookal interaction. But I have to look into the, you know, I don't know off the top of my hand what the values are. These two are DNA. This is the solvent. This is what I said. Something like that, yeah. But it's, of course, different in this direction than in this direction. Yeah. But, you know, we can talk later and look at the numbers. Apart from these interactions, and this is what we usually term the DLVO interactions, the term stems from the Dryagin-Landau-Verbey-Overbeck theory from the 40s, and the total interaction between colloidal particles there is assumed to be of the form the bihuclear repulsion or Poisson-Boltzmann repulsion plus van der Waals forces. This is what I talked about. But also, we know now that if you actually measure interactions between colloidal bodies at very small separations, you see an additional force on top of the usual DLVO forces that is quite universal. It appears between different lipid bilayers, between these different polyelectrolytes, most notably between DNA molecules. And it does not depend on the salt concentration, and it doesn't even depend on the presence of counterions. You can see that by taking another polyelectrolyte like schizophyllin, which is a zwitterionic polyelectrolyte, no counterions, and you see again the same type of forces. This force is not really well understood since it depends at these small separations on different molecular details. We have to take into account the details of the solvent molecule, the water molecule, the details of the ions, the details of the structure of the DNA surface, the dynamics of the DNA surface, and so on. So we really don't understand, I have to say that honestly, we don't understand all the details about this force that acts in the last 10 angstroms between the contact. But there are indications, and these are known for a long time, that you can take into account approximately the structure of water between the interacting bodies, and that will give you an additional repulsive force, which could be what you see in the experiments. If this is the case, then an old theory proposed by Stefan Nocella, I think in the 70s, will give us the dependence of this additional hydration interaction on the separation between the interacting bodies, which is similar to what you have for the electrostatic interactions, except that the constant is different and the decay length does not depend on the salt concentration. It's universal depending on the solvent properties, and usually it's about 3 angstroms. Also, if you're not satisfied with that, we can just take a scaling form that we get from the fit to the experiment and use that. I will not go into details here because I'll only use this equation to fit what I will fit later on. Another interaction that we are only beginning to appreciate, it's the interaction first calculated by Alexei Korinshev and Sergei Lakin, which depends on the detailed structure of the charge along DNA. DNA is not a smeared cylinder. It has charges wound around it on 2 helices. Yeah? And if we take into account the exact distribution of these charges, we see that the interaction between DNA molecules, and you should look at this figure here, depends on this angle between them. Yeah? So if you take 2 molecules, because of the distribution of the charges on phosphates, if you turn around the molecule, the energy will change. And you see that at separations larger than approximately 35 angstroms, the preferred angle, this angle is 0, whereas at smaller, it's finite and saturates at this value right here for very small interaction separations. And what you have here is simply the complete dependence of the interaction at different interaction spacing on the value of the 2 angles. And I'm sure Sergei or Alexei will tell you more in their talks about this interaction. So besides the LVO forces, we have other interactions, mostly at very small separations. One is what I call the hydration interaction. The other one is the force I just described to you, which is due. Hydration interaction is due to the probably to the solvent structure and probably to the structure, detailed atomic structure of the surfaces that are interacting. And the other force depends on the distribution of the charges along DNA molecules. Exact distribution. So you have 2 helices winding around and so on. If we now take the interactions that I was talking about and try to figure out whether they are enough to understand the equation of state that you saw before, we get discouraged because what we get is this line here. So this is the DLVO prediction for the equation of state, right here. And obviously, this is the measurement. It's way off. Something is we are missing an important thing, and apparently we are missing more at small densities than at large densities. What is it that we are missing in this theory? So, what do I have here? Once again, this is the DLVO prediction. This is the measurement. There is a huge discrepancy between the two. And here, we take a lesson from the physics of multilamellar lipid or membrane arrays. We know that polymers, just as lipid membranes, are flexible macromolecules. They're stiff only on short length scales, like the persistence length, which I showed you was about 50 nanometers, but at longer scales, they're very, very flexible. This flexibility we have not taken into account while we try to figure out what the equation of state was. And we know that for lamellar systems, and this is a work that goes way back to Helfrich, and many other people have contributed to this understanding that we have today of the multilamellar lipid bilayer assemblies. And from this work, it is clear that flexibility, conformational flexibility of the membranes, is essential to understand the equation of state or the osmotic pressure that acts in an assembly like that. So if we have a certain interaction between layers in a stack that is described by this VDLVO, if we allow the layers to fluctuate, the effective interaction potential will change dramatically. Not only will it get another term, which is like a steric, what we call a Helfrich force, acting between bilayers, but also the original DLVO terms that are in this potential will get modified. And this is the hypothesis that we make at this point, that the same is probably true for ordered arrays of polymers. What we didn't take into account is the fact that polymers are flexible, that they fluctuate, and we have to take into account these fluctuations to understand the equation of state. Let's see if this hypothesis works. So just as the membranes, which can be described with the curvature energy right here, and you know the expression, the curvature modulus, curvature squared integrated over area, we know that for a membrane, that membrane is essentially stiff on scales that are smaller than something called the Topin de Gennes persistence length, and is very flexible on the scales larger than that. It turns out, just because of the geometry, that this length scale is very large. So mostly, membranes would be flat. But for polymers, this is different. If we look at the polymers, the same thing, curvature energy, elastic constant, curvature squared, integrated over the length of the polymer, we see that the persistence length effects, or the curvature effects, are negligible for DNA below about 50 nanometers, and above that, we always have to take them into account. So the question is, how do we take this finite flexibility effects into account when we talk about the equation of state? How does one do that? And this is a simplified story that I will give you. First of all, for for confined membranes, we know that if we take the elastic energy right here in the approximation of small deviations from the flat state, that after applying a equipartition theorem to that, we see that the fluctuations of the mean of the position of the membrane go as the area of the membrane, and when they become the fluctuation, when they become larger than the spacing available to this membrane, there will be an additional force with which the membrane acts on the boundaries on this surface and on this surface, and this force has been calculated by Helfrich a long time ago, and we know that it goes scales as 1 over d squared. So there's an additional interaction coming from the flexibility of the membrane that goes as 1 over d squared. And the same thing can be done for polymers, same type of thinking. We just enclose now a polymer within a tube and take the elastic energy. We look at the correlations in the tangential vector of the polymer, defined right here, and we see that it's exponential. It's a well-known result following from the theory of flexible polymers. And if we develop this for small deviations from a straight line, we will see again, and I don't want to go through all the details, the calculation was done by Odike in 84, we see that the same type of force that you have in the membrane that goes as 1 over d squared, for polymers it would go as 1 over d to the minus 2/3. The difference is only due to geometry, to different geometry. Now, of course, we don't really have a polymer enclosed within a tube, because we don't have a crystal. The lesson that we got from the mesophases the DNA makes is that during the whole regime of density, it's liquid-like. It's never crystalline. It only crystallizes into a real crystal, but otherwise, it's never crystalline. There is no hexagonal columnar liquid crystalline phase. You have line hexadic and cholesteric, always liquid. So in a liquid polymer, we should set up our theory in a different way. We started with a polymer pneumatic right here, and of course we know that for very long polymers, and this is known from the work of Degenne, Bob Meyer, and most notably Selinger and Brunsma, that the density fluctuations are coupled to the pneumatic director fluctuations. That's easily seen if you think of spaghetti, and if you try to squeeze them in the middle, the profile of the director around the point where you're trying to squeeze them will change. And that simply means that the density and the director correlations are coupled. So apart from all the energy terms that we want to take into account, we have to take into account this condition that is valid for long, very long polymers. And what kind of energy contributions do we have here? One is, of course, as for any pneumatic, it's display energy, the twist contribution, the bend contribution, and, of course, the part of the free energy that is due to the fluctuations in the density, which is stemming from the compressibility of our system. So these are the four terms that we have to take into account. I have assumed here that the deviations from a straight line are small and that the density deviations from the equilibrium density are also small. So the total free energy will have these four terms, plus the term that comes from the fact that we have to take into account the constraint between density and orientational fluctuations. Now if we do that, and I don't really want to go into all the details, this is the free energy that we start with. As I already said, it's got 1, 2, 3, 4 terms, which are the energy terms, and another term which simply corresponds to the coupling between the density and the orientational fluctuations. And now, if we integrate out the density fluctuations and then integrate out the director fluctuations, we end up with a free energy, which corresponds to the fluctuations, be it density fluctuations or pneumatic director fluctuations at different densities. And you see what I have here are two limiting expressions. The formula, general formula, is quite complicated, so I listed only two expressions. This is a high density limit. This is a low density limit. The only thing I would like you to see, really, is that in the high density limit, the fluctuational free energy depends on the fourth root of the compressibility modulus. In the low density limit, the second root of the compressibility. Also, we have to take into account the fact that we don't really know what the microscopic physics is in a polymer array, so we have to, when we do the Fourier integrals, we have to take a cutoff at a certain value, maximal value, of the Fourier vector perpendicular to the long axis of the molecules. And you can easily convince yourself that the value of this cutoff is nothing but the correlation length for the correlation function in the plane perpendicular to the long axis of the molecule. So this Q max would simply be 1 over D, where D is the average spacing between molecules. Now, how do we understand this result? Once again, I put it up right here. So we have two expressions, the high density limit, the small density limit, depends on BK3, BK1. This is the bending modulus, the splay modulus. And how can we easily understand these two formulas? Well, though I said that we don't really deal with the, we are not dealing with a crystal, we can make a sort of an effective tube model or an effective crystal model or an effective Einstein model if you want. We take a single polymer molecule and put it in a tube, and the tube will simulate the effects of its neighbors. And then we just develop the interaction with the neighbors around the mean position within the tube, which is of course zero in the middle of the tube. Doing that to the second order, we end up with this part in the Hamiltonian, and the first part is nothing but of course the elastic energy. And with an energy like that, you immediately see that it's governed by a length scale given by the deflection length, which is the length that the polymer has to make before it, the interaction energy, this term, becomes equal to kT. And if you now evaluate the free energy corresponding to this type of fluctuations within a soft tube, you get a fourth root of the second derivative of the interaction potential, which is exactly, basically, or analogous to what you have right here. The fourth root of B is analogous in an effective tube model to the fourth root of the second derivative of the potential between the nearest neighbors. And the same thing can be done in a different limit where now the part of the Hamiltonian governing the conformational fluctuations is not elastic, but is sort of tension-like. So it's the first derivative squared as opposed to the second derivative squared. And if you take this Hamiltonian, the final fluctuation interaction energy will be proportional to the second root of the second derivative of V. And that result, of course, is analogous to this term right here. So the way to understand the fluctuational energy in a polymer array is to take an effective tube model or an effective Einstein model where you put a single polymer in an effective tube composed of its neighbors and see what the interaction energy of a polymer in this model is. And you can easily see that the two limiting forms for this interaction are in effect completely consistent with what you get with the appropriate calculation. Appropriate in the sense that you have a fluid, a liquid system and not a real crystal. So let's just check whether this result works. This is the general form of the result. The limit of this particular function I have already shown you, the high density, the low density limit. This is the complete expression now. And what you do is you use a trick or a self-consistent consistency argument invented by Helfrich, where you take for steric interactions now only, you say that the compressibility right here is proportional, osmotic compressibility is proportional to the second derivative of the free energy. You put that in this equation. And you get a self-consistent equation between the free energy and its derivatives. You see, on this side you have free energy, here you have derivatives in B. So it's a self-consistent relation between F and its derivatives. And now if you solve this self-consistent equation, you get three density regimes. High density regime, right here, it's the same as that the dependence of the interaction free energy or steric interaction free energy is the same as the one derived by O'Dike and a year before that by Helfrich and Harvey. At intermediate densities, you get a formula which is effectively consistent with the result derived by Selinger and Brunsma for nematic polymers. And at very low density, you have a different scaling limit, which I'm not really sure whether it corresponds to any physical situation because density goes to zero. I mean, before you hit that, you will go isotropic. So formally, of course, I can list these three limiting results, but physically, it's only these two that would be of relevance. So for most of the regime of the densities, you have the Selinger-Brunsma result, and then at very large density, you go to a result valid effectively for a crystal, and that, I think, is completely reasonable. But now comes the surprise. Now you take, of course, the scaling results. Scaling forms of the fluctuation-free energy, valid for only steric interaction. Now the interaction potential is just steric part, no soft potential. And you try to see whether it's doing better if you compare it to the experiment. And here is the experiment. Here are the fits to the fluctuational free energy that you get for a hexagonal columnar liquid crystal. This is the first result that I showed. And the second one is for an emetic. This is the Selinger-Brunsma result. And you see that they don't really... These are the osmotic pressure lines or curves for three values of the concentration of the salt. And first of all, you see that if you want to fit these dependencies to a scaling form v to the minus something, the exponent in this form, v to the minus n, the n depends on the ionic strength. That's not a good sign. So if you want to make a fit of the experiment to the scaling for v to the minus 1 that to rationalize through this little calculation that I've shown you before, you see that you have to have an exponent that depends on the ionic strength. That's not a good sign. Also, if you look at the, right here we have v to the minus 4 thirds, 5 thirds, the two will never be made, I mean, you can't really fit this experimental data with the two scaling forms. So there's something, again, which is missing. Yeah? We cannot fit the experiment to the purely steric interactions. We have to take into account more detail in the interaction potential. Yeah?
What will these volumes correspond in action if we calculate for distances?
Oh, distances? Well, yeah. I think 900 milligrams per milliliter would be like the separation 25, if I'm not mistaken. Sergey, can you check me on that? Are you following? No. And 10 milligrams per milliliter would be like about 200 angstrom. Oh, really? I had it there?
Yeah. Well, you can see where the break is.
Sorry. If I find it. Here, as I said, 25, 30. Yeah? And that would be, I think, 900 mg per mil. And down here, 200, or here, no, sorry, here. This would be 120 angstrom spacing would correspond to about 10 mg per mil. Mg per mil, milligrams of DNA per milliliter of solution. Yeah. Oh, it's... Oh. He withdraws it. Okay, I understand that. Good. Where was I? Steric interactions are not enough to fit the experiment. We have to take a more detailed form of the interaction potential. So what do we do? We take the interaction potential in the form that is reasonable from the DLVO arguments and what I told you about the interactions that you can see in the last 10 angstroms before the contact. Right here, we take the interaction potential in the form of a hydration force or a short-range force that does not depend on the ionic strength. The bihookal term right here, which depends, as I showed you before, on the separation, and we just omit the van der Waals interaction because, as I told you, in most of the density range that we are taking a look at, it's about 1 to 2 orders of magnitude smaller. So this is all we remain with. And now we have to do a really, really approximate theory because we just can't or don't know how to do it better. So we just take the scaling forms of the elastic constants, these are the twists, and the twist and the splay modulus for DNA. This is the bending modulus of the DNA. The form, as you know, is this one, where V is the interaction potential between the molecules. The only interesting thing is that the stiffness, the bending modulus has part in it, which is due to the intrinsic DNA stiffness. The stiffness modulus itself does not come entirely from the interactions between the DNA molecules, but has a part which is due to the fact that DNA is intrinsically stiff. And you have to take that into account, of course. And the B, the compressibility modulus, is just standardly, you know, the compressibility modulus right here. And now you take the fluctuation free energy that I derived before, and you try to figure out what kind of form you have to take into account in order to describe the fluctuation contribution to the total free energy with this interaction potential. Yeah? And what it turns out is that, first of all, the term, this term, in the expression for K3, for the stiffness, for the bending modulus, is always larger than this one if the separation between DNAs is larger than 30 angstroms, which is basically the whole range that we are looking at. So along the whole range of DNA densities that we want to understand what's going on, we have this term larger than this one. So K3 is only equal to this. This is a very important point, because if that wouldn't be the case, the results would be completely different. Also, if you look at the limiting expressions for the fluctuational part of the free energy, you see that you only have to take into account one, the high energy form of the fluctuation free energy, because the parameters for the DNA are such that this form is the only one that's reasonable. So you end up at the end with the following expression. This is a total free energy of our pneumatic polymer, pneumatic DNA phase. It's got the free energy has a part in it which is not due to the fluctuations, which is proportional just to the bare interaction potential, and a part which is proportional, which is due to the fact that the molecules are allowed to fluctuate, that they are not ideally stiff, but are stiff only on a certain length scale. And then, of course, once you have the free energy, you get the osmotic pressure, and now you compare this to the experiment. And it turns out that this time, the comparison works. So what I have here is a picture you've already seen, but now I want to draw your attention to this line here. This is the fit to the osmotic pressure experimental equation of state data. And what I have here is the DLVO line without, so the same interaction potential, but without the fluctuations in the position of the molecules here. This is the effect of the fluctuation. You see, you can really fit nicely the whole range of the DNA densities, where DNA is first of all pneumatic and second of all it's liquid. Yeah? This is from up here down to where it becomes isotropic. Up here it's crystalline, you can't really fit that region. Down here it's isotropic, completely different physics, you can say nothing about that. But in between, you can fit the whole regime with a single expression for the osmotic pressure. And what I have here is only a curve for a single ionic strength. This is 0.5 molar sodium chloride, but you can do that consistently for all the ionic strength that you want to. So from 2 molars to 0.1 molar, you can fit just as well as you can do for this ionic strength.
How many fitting parameters do
you have? It's just the value of the charge on DNA. This is a free parameter, the only free parameter. And thank you for this question.
Because
pardon? Oh, attraction. I told you that attraction is about 1 to 2 orders of magnitude smaller than the repulsive interaction, so we just forget about it.
For this situation,
yes. So once you fit the experimental curves, the experimental equation of state, you can get all the parameters that are in your interaction potential. Out of that, you can get the surface charge or effective line charge on DNA. And you can see these are the fits for 1 molar, 0.5 molar, 0.1 molar, sodium chloride. You see that the charge basically remains the same. Why weren't we able to do the same fit for 1 molar DNA? For 1 molar DNA, the decay length is very close to the hydration decay length. You can't say what is what, and you can't really say whether you are fitting A or B, and that's why I can't get a good estimate for the value of the charge at this ionic strength. But for the other two cases, I get the same density, the same surface, effective surface charge density of DNA. And now if I compare this result to the predictions of the Manning theory, I see that I haven't really decided that this is a confirmation of the Manning theory or not. There's a little bit of a difference, or a lot of a difference. It depends how you look at it. Manning would say that there's a 50%, that there's a 75%, the charge is, you only see 25% of the charge. The rest of it is, the rest of the counter ion is uncondensed, and what we see is 50%. So there's a difference, 50 versus 25, that you get from this type of fit to the equation of state data. Also, in due fairness, this is the experimental number. This is the experiment, right here.
From your reduction of the data, but there's another measurement made to get that same number, and I thought they were right on Manning's
Well, first of all, what you get here is directly the interaction parameters, not values of zeta potentials or something like that. You get directly the interaction parameter. And I'm not aware of any other experiment where people do that. Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm not saying, that's why I said, I'm not saying this either, you know, words for it or against it. I'm saying this is the number that you get from the type of, first of all, the type of experiment that I described to you, and also the type of theoretical analysis that I described to you. Oh, okay. Only in maybe let me finish and then, is that okay? And then you ask questions. In due fairness, I have to also mention the work, recent work by Cassapido and van der Marel, which effectively took our data, but the fit that they made is a little bit different. They were taking it, what they started with is the Hamiltonian for a crystalline array, meaning a hexagonal columnar liquid crystalline phase. And for that Hamiltonian, you can do the same type of analysis, get the fluctuational free energy, compare it to experiment, this and that. But the main difference is that we say DNA is liquid all the way to the crystalline phase. And they would say it's liquid in the, only in the cholesteric phase, but above that, between cholesteric and the crystalline phase, it's hexagonal columnar liquid crystalline, and we use a different theory for that. And you can compare by yourself. This is their fit right here. I think it starts to take off as soon as DNA is really in the cholesteric phase. So I would say that it doesn't really describe the physics pertinent to the cholesteric phase, which we do, and we have a better fit for that. But I have to mention this work. This is what just came out. Yes?
When you do the calculation of the fluctuating polymer in a tube,
yeah,
in a way you're also assuming some kind of...
Yeah, but I, yes, I have to stress here, the tube model is just a heuristic model, because, yeah, okay. I use, I mean, a different type of calculation to get the real formula to fit. Yeah. Okay, this is it. This is the people that have worked for many years on this problem. Of course, Adrian Posijan, Klaus Gavrisch, Helmut Stry, Donald Rau, they're all from NIH. Alan Ruprecht, I have to mention once again, University of Stockholm, probably the greatest guy to do oriented DNA samples. Then there's Lipo Yu from NIH, Jim Wang, Eric Sirota, Exxon, and I would like to thank many other people for valuable discussions and all the things that we talked about. And this is it. Thank you. Yes. Not really. I have to upgrade my statement here. We also, of course, we fit also A, but A does not depend on the ionic strength. That's the point. So you fit it for one curve, and basically it remains the same afterwards. Right here.
So A was something we didn't
see. Ionic strength, yeah. You also get from the fit that it doesn't depend on the ionic strength.
The amount of charge bound may not depend on ionic strength.
Excuse me?
Amount of charge bound may not depend on ionic strength.
It does not, because the sigma, the effective surface charge density on DNA that you get from the fit, is constant and independent of the ionic strength. Okay, maybe we can, you know, discuss it more.
I'm trying to understand the physics of your model. For the case of membranes, it's sort of obvious that the membrane between two other membranes has no place to go, so it has to just wiggle out between. For the case of DNA, and the difference between DLVO and the data was getting worse and worse to go to lower density.
Yeah.
It looks like at 50 angstrom, there is plenty of room between strands for another strand to go around. So why would this perfect cylinder or cylindrical model, why would there be any kind of confining?
Okay, I have to now really phrase this carefully. The cylinder model, or the Einstein model that I use, is a heuristic model. This is not how I calculated the forces, the interaction. I use the pneumatic Hamiltonian, where you have all these fluctuations. The chains can go any way they want. They're not enclosed into any tube. And you get an equation for the free energy. And I'm saying this equation, the result, can be understood on the basis of an Einstein model. But the Einstein model is incorrect, strictly speaking, because you don't have a crystalline lattice, as you pointed out.
Density, right?
Yes, true.
So
no, that this has to be, I mean, there is a difference.
Of course there is.
Yeah. Between what? Between what? Transitions? Yeah. Okay, and yeah. The accuracy of the experiment, of course, is limited. What you know for sure is that there is a first-order transition between the crystalline phase and the line-hexatic phase. The line-hexatic to cholesteric phase appears to be second-order, or very weak first-order transition. And then, of course, you have first-order from the cholesteric to isotropic.
You had originally some question marks in there with some extra phases.
Exactly.
You want to say a few words about that?
What you get when you do X-ray scattering is that instead of a single first-order peak, you get a broad one and a sharp one. And we don't know what that is. And this is just in the small region of the densities, just between the two phases. I can't really have no idea what it is.
I didn't quite gather what you said about the cholesteric. I mean, if I understood it, the simple theory doesn't explain the cholesteric phase.
It does.
It does.
Yes.
When you put in the sine theta,
you mean explain the osmotic pressure?
Well, the appearance of the phase.
No, no, that's fine. Yeah.
That comes out.
Yeah.
And then it fits the osmotic pressure in the same way.
Yeah.
Wait. You get a cholesteric order parameter developing from your theory?
No. Yeah. We have an equation of state, which is P, osmotic pressure, as a function of the volume. But you have, you know, there are other theories, and I didn't go into that, that completely describe the transition from the isotropic phase to the pneumatic phase, most notably theory of Hofflauf, Grossberg, and so on. But I didn't want to go into that.
But in what you described, it's a one-phase theory. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a pneumatic polymer.
My question is related to that experiment. All these phases, are they optically active or not?
Well, definitely the cholesteric phase is optically active. Yeah. This is an interesting point. When John Toner proposed his N plus 6 phase, he theorized that this phase should be opaque. Yeah? Should be like milky white. And indeed, if I just give you samples of DNA, you will see that the crystal is transparent. Then the cholesteric phase is completely transparent. And in between, you have something that's milky. And this is exactly the line hexatic phase. He was right. It scatters.
Okay,
sorry.
We don't hear you.
Can't hear you.
Could you comment on the entanglement between the molecules, really long molecules, entanglement maintained, which moves so slowly, way slower than the
When you expand the sample, you mean? Whether there will be any entanglement contribution. Probably not, because these experiments have been done on all sorts of different time scales. And I would assume that if there are any entanglement effects, they will not... it has been taken care of, sort of. I don't expect them to be large.
Good. Thank you very much.